Hey, everybody, welcome to the Flap Operator Podcast, the view from the right seat, representing the little guys, the helper pilots, the first officer's view from what the passengers call that little thing. That's right, the flight deck of the CRJ-200. Coming to you live this week from good old Toronto, Canada, eh? So for those of you who are just new to the Flap Operator Podcast, a little background here. My name is Chris. I'm a first officer. I fly at a regional airline on the East Coast of the United States. I also work as a cockpit procedures training instructor. It's CPT is the abbreviation here for my airline. So just thought I'd make a podcast. I kind of was inspired by the airline pilot guy and airplane geeks, and just thought I had a unique perspective to share working in the 121 air carrier environment and also working in the training department at my particular airline. Get to see a lot of kind of thought-provoking issues pop up from the training side of things, and also get to run into a lot of interesting issues working here at the airlines in the training department, and just kind of being an airplane geek myself, so kind of plugged into the aviation world. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear a podcast from a from an FO. So I don't think I ever explained either if up to this point, but where I got the name Flap Operator, the co-pilot is called a first officer, which is abbreviated FO, and the joke is that FO stands for flap operator, because that's all the captain will ever let you do is swing the gear and drop the flap. So a little bit of a joke. I just thought I'd throw that in there. Flap operator. The joke is. FO stands for, and also where I got the name of the podcast. So trying to improve here every episode as we go along. I'm just trying to take some notes from the big guys here. So this episode, I wanted to talk a little, some news I saw recently, looking at the blogs and, on the websites on the line. I just watched the interns, I guess, about Vince Vaughn and what's his name? The little guy with the blonde hair about, being interns at Google. And there's a part in the movie where he's, I won't try to spoil it if you want to watch it, but, where he's trying to say online and he keeps saying on the line. Getting my news from on the line. A little bit of news to talk about, and then I wanted to share how I got my start in aviation. I started flying really young. I'm 23 right now, so I started flying when I was 15 and was interested in aviation before then. I'm the first of my family, extended family, even to be a pilot, so just thought I'd share my unique experience, how I got to where I am today, aspirations for the future, and give some advice. Hopefully I can introduce aviation to somebody out there who isn't, who doesn't know how to get their start. And then I was, wanted to talk about emergency procedures. I had a question from, a passenger while I was deadheading up here to, good old YYZ, Toronto, Canada, asked me about, emergencies. Like, if your engine fails, how do you know what to do? Oh my God, the airplane's going to crash. Oh my God. No. We have procedures, which is actually a really good question, because that's all I do all day long. My job, I teach cockpit procedures training. So I make sure that my students who are pilot trainees, new hire pilots at my airline, that they have a good solid grasp on their procedures, what to do basically when the engine quits, before we send them into the simulator where things actually move in the bells go off and the whistles go off and all that fun stuff. So talk a little bit about emergency procedures. And then I made a blog post about fuel burn, and I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about that. Again, another passenger I was deadheading last month? Yeah, the end of October, I was coming back from Charlotte when I was doing some training, and a passenger behind me was talking a little bit about how inefficient he thought airplanes were, and kind of got me thinking. I ran some numbers and came up with some pretty interesting results. So kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that. So this news thing, I guess first and foremost, is the FAA repeals their ban of personal electronic devices, the PEDs, to be used on airliners. I know I actually had an issue recently where I was operating a flight, a U.S. Airways flight in the back, and I had my uniform on. I was non-revenue flying. I was flying standby with my travel benefits as a pilot, flying non-rev from here to there. I don't even remember where I was going. And a passenger had their phone on, and the flight attendant came by and said, you know, sir, we've made the announcement. You have to turn your phone off. And he goes, no, no, no. The FAA changed, you know, X, Y, and Z policy. And the flight attendant said, you know, she was polite. She said, my airline hasn't implemented that policy yet. You still have to turn your phone off. And this was a business gentleman. He was up in first class, as was I. And the flight attendant, he got quite angry with the flight attendant. Didn't cause a disturbance, but he was visibly agitated and gave her kind of a nasty look. He did turn his phone off in the end because he was sitting fairly close to me and another flight attendant. When he started kind of giving her attitude, popped her head out of the galley. So I think he attracted some unwanted attention and turned his phone off. But just a little note in there for all of you who are traveling soon or will be traveling shortly. Not all airlines have permission to abide by this policy. It may sound kind of strange. The reason I say that and the reason that is that each individual air carrier, each individual airline who has permission from the federal government to operate as an airline has to seek approval for their specific operation to be able to allow personal electronic devices to be used under the guidelines of the new regulation that came out, or regulations that govern personal electronic devices. So apparently U.S. Airways still does not govern that. So this gentleman was thinking, well, the federal government said, yeah, we can use personal electronic devices. Woohoo! Silly flight attendant, she must not know what she's talking about, but that's actually not the case. I know for my particular company, I think the day or the day after that announcement came out, we all got an email, or they call it an announcement. It shows up on our company website that said, even though the FAA has changed their policy, my airline has not received approval. So for now, they gave some verbiage on what they want the flight attendant to say, a new statement that's going to go into the announcement saying basically what I've said already. You know, the FAA changed their policy, but we still have not changed our policy. So please basically give us your patience and just humor our flight attendants until they change that. So that's exciting, though. I mean, finally, it's about time. You know, how long have people been complaining about not being able to use their cell phones? I don't know, there's a lot of times that I'm deadheading around in the back of the airplane going to or from training or trying to get to work that it'd be nice to have, you know, just be able to listen to an audiobook on tape or listen to iTunes, you know, even though the transmitting capabilities have to be off. A lot of what I read, my blogs, news feeds, stuff like that, even my company documents, if I'm going to work and I have to, you know, study up on a certain subject before I get to training, or if I'm going to a recurrent ground school or, you know, something to that effect, even even being able to have the iPad out and reading on the iPad or watching a movie. There's a lot of times when you ride around in airplanes long enough, inevitably you'll get stuck in a delay. You're sitting on the ground for 2.5 hours and the flight attendant or the flight crew decides that it's not okay for you to have your PEDs, your personal electronic devices, powered on, where, you know, for 2 hours, if you don't have a book, like a hard copy book, paperback, or, you know, what have you, there's nothing to do but try to take a nap or look out the window or make conversation with the person next to you. So I guess this world's a little ADD and we all like our electronic devices, but just make things a little bit easier traveling with having your PEDs on. So that's kind of an exciting update. Just I would ask for all of you out there, non-airline personnel listening, if you are going to travel, please look and see if your carrier has approval to use personal electronic devices. And if they don't hassle the flight attendant. You know, it's not her fault. It's not the flight crew's fault that paperwork takes such a darn long time. So a little bit of patience will go a long way for everybody. And I'm sure the pilots out there listening and the flight attendants and the flight crews and really anybody who works in the airlines is appreciative of that as well. So that's that. PEDs, that's exciting. There's a glider project, which I have been following for a couple of months now, snippets here and there that I thought was interesting to share. There is a a project, the Perlin Project, which is building a, it's a group of people who are building a pressurized glider. It's no engines, just a glider, that's going to try and ride some rising air off the Andes Mountains called Mountain Wave, or created by orographic lifting. It's really neither here nor there, but Mountain Wave. They're going to try and fly this glider on the turbulence from this, from the mountain range up to 60,000 feet. When they get to 60,000 feet, they think they're going to be able to catch, I'm saying catch and I'm making the quotes in the air in front of me, catch the polar vortex, which I'm reading the article here. This is a blog off of Jetwine, I think this is. You guys ever read the Jetwine blog? A lot of interesting aviation news. The circulating winds that act like a giant cyclone during the austral winter, delivering a strong uplift. It says this glider has an 84-foot wingspan and supposedly can reach altitudes of 90,000 feet, where it can study the ozone hole and set a new altitude record while doing it. There's a picture on the blog here of a gentleman basically dressed up in a spacesuit, a bunch of tubes and things hooked up to him, almost kind of looks like an astronaut, which I suppose you would have to wear if you're going to fly at 90,000 feet. It's crazy. A glider to 90,000 feet? Maybe it's just me, or maybe I'm just kind of weird, but when I see something like that, I say, heck yeah, man. Sign me up. You guys need a glider pilot, I'm your man. I don't have a glider rating, but I could go to Arizona and get one. A friend of mine lives out there. Go get myself a good old glider rating and just hop in one of these unpowered bad boys and zoom right up to 90,000 feet. Something tells me they're not going to let me do it, but that just sounds like a heck of a lot of fun. My mom's probably listening, just shaking her head, going, please stay on the ground. Why can't you get a desk job? Well, that seems kind of neat. If you guys ever get a chance to read about this project, the Perlin, am I saying that right? Perlin, P-E-R-L-A-N, the Perlin Project. Google it. A lot of really neat information in there. I don't know what you study with the ozone hole. It's disappearing. You take atmospheric measurements, I suppose. See how much ozone is in, how much ozone gas is in that part of the atmosphere. I don't know. Not really sure. So that's something interesting I ran across while I was reading online. Also, there's some news about the Asiana 214 crash. The pilots are claiming now that the 777 they were flying, the Asiana 214, I'm talking, of course, about the Asiana Airlines Flight 214 that crashed doing the visual to, I believe it was 28 left at SFO, to San Francisco out there, International Airport. That was back in July, maybe? July, September, October. Yeah, 3 months ago or so. Just a quick rundown for those of you who aren't familiar. Basically, the airplane got really slow while doing a visual approach down into like the 110 knot range, which, you know, 777's a big, humongous airplane. So it's pretty impressive, actually, how slow on Boeing's part. It's impressive. You know, kudos to Boeing that the airplane actually is capable of flying down into the 100 knot range. Got really slow, dipped, was low, I say dipped low, the glide slope, got really low on the approach, struck the seawall, I think, or the barrier wall there, just short of the runway. The airplane split in two. I think the tail kind of fell off, they lost an engine, slid along the runway, and then there was a fire. There were three fatalities, which were unfortunate, but for the number of people who were on the airplane, it really is incredible that everybody survived the crash. Again, a testament to Boeing and the superior American-built product that they were flying. Not saying that Airbus is bad, but, you know, gotta give the props to the American-built airline while I have the opportunity before we're all flying Airbus A380s. Well, the Dreamliner will be around for a while, I guess, so. So this, the pilots basically were giving a statement to the NTSB in which they said, they told investigators that their auto throttle system had malfunctioned. Now, Auto throttles, again, for those of you who aren't familiar, are basically like cruise control. You're in your car. They are connected to computers, which are connected to the autopilot and various systems in the airplane, and they basically control the thrust coming out of the engines to control speed. It's just an automated system that gives increased accuracy along with increased or decreased pilot workload. So in an airplane this big, it kind of alleviates the pilots, especially during bad weather and inclement weather, gusty winds and things like that, from having to constantly be adjusting the thrust of the airplane to maintain the appropriate speed. Now, I don't fly a 777, but I can just take some guesses the airplane probably weighs, 300-something thousand pounds when it lands. Average landing weight. I think the 777 can do something like 700,000 pounds gross takeoff. Correct me if I'm wrong. A little less than that, 600 maybe. Probably should have Googled that before I said anything. I know it's the big version, this 777ER, is probably close to 750,000 pounds gross takeoff weight. So, you know, maybe 200,000 pounds of that is fuel or a little bit less. So, I mean, 500,000 pounds gross landing weight. For every knot of airspeed that's increased, I'm sure is a tremendous amount of additional kinetic energy you have to stop. So that's one of the benefits also of the auto throttles, is that it keeps the airplane on the speed in which it needs to land at, the ref speed, the approach speed, within a couple of knots. So it decreases the amount of energy the aircraft has to dissipate to safely land, with thrust, reverse, and brakes. And brake temperatures on these airplanes, you know, can get up into the 500-700 degrees Celsius range. You know, that's pretty darn hot. Really, really, really hot. So that a little bit about auto throttles there. So the pilot said that the auto throttle system malfunctioned. I'm quoting from the article. Again, this is from Jetwine, but I saw this in a couple of different places. They swear it was properly set at the beginning of their approach, but that they didn't work as expected. They got too low and too slow, and the pilots never noticed until it was too late. Now, for those pilots of you listening out there, I'm sure you've heard quite a lot about this Asiana 214 crash. The international community has kind of been clamoring, going, well, was the airplane unsafe? Were the pilots not trained right? You know, was there some procedure that should be fixed? And I can't help but be frustrated as a pilot, as a commercial pilot, as an airline pilot myself, although I fly, you know, the teeny tiny airplanes. Still, as a pilot of a jet-powered airplane that essentially follows the same, you know, aerodynamic principles behind the power curve, you know, keep the engine spooled up, you know, all those concepts you get while flying a swept-wing jet. I just can't help but think, you know, pitch plus power equals performance. For me, I can feel the airplane move around me. I can feel when it begins to get slow. You know, I can, if I'm looking outside and I'm hand flying, I've got a hand on the control yoke and I've got, you know, my right hand on the control yoke and my left hand on the thrust levers, I can feel the airplane, you know, begin to slow down. And even by the time I look down at the airspeed indicator, you know, I can sense a speed movement or an energy loss in the airplane before the trend vector, before the air data computer even calculates it and then displays it to me as a pilot. You can feel that stuff. It's what we call seat of the pants flying. You know, you can feel the machine move around you. And I can't imagine that two pilots couldn't tell they had lost 30 knots. I mean, that's huge. A 30-knot loss, the pitch, you know, the change in pitch attitude had to be incredible. I know, just as a point of reference in my particular airplane, the CRJ-200, if we, you know, our typical ref speed's pretty high, actually. We're a Category D approach airplane, the highest, I think the only Category D approach airliner in service in the United States, or maybe one of the only. Don't hold me to that. If any of you are listening and you actually get you you know if of another one, you know, leave me some feedback, let me know. But we come in final approach speed at 47,000 pounds, which is our max landing weight, at 143 knots or so, 145 knots. So we come in pretty fast. For us to lose 30 knots, so for us to slow to 110 knots, we approach at 2.5 degrees nose down at flaps 45. We probably would stall at around 7.5 degrees nose up. So that's a total pitch change of 10 degrees. That's huge, a 10-degree pitch change. I can't imagine myself along with a captain that, you know, all the captains at my airline are really good. We don't have any people who are, you know, dangerous. I can't imagine that between the two of us, we wouldn't notice a 10-degree change in pitch attitude, for crying out loud. 10 degrees, that's huge. Okay, before I start yelling at my computer screen, that's how I feel though when I read this. They swear it was connected and set up properly, and then apparently nobody noticed that the engine power wasn't coming up, which again is basic pilotage for you pilots out there listening to this. How often do you guys pay attention to the sound of your engine? Constantly, right? You know, you listen to your engine's drone for hours and hours and hours and hours throughout your career. And, you know, when something doesn't sound right, it grabs your attention right away. You look down at the gauges and you can see, you know, you've got, you know, problem A, B, or C, and deal with them appropriately. So the fact that the Asiana pilots are claiming their auto throttles, you know, were disconnected and it wasn't their fault, it just, you know, it's basic pilotage, I think. It's basic piloting skills. I think it's, they're grasping at straws there. If I scroll down here, looking at this article, they also said that the aircraft had, in its maintenance log, notes or other additional times when the auto throttle system on that particular airplane had been reported already with uncommanded auto throttle disconnects. But again, it's like, you know, well, so what? You know, as a pilot, you should ultimately be able to take control of the aircraft that you're flying, no matter what the, no matter what the systems are doing. You're ultimately a pilot. Right? I mean, that's why we train you. That's why you have to have thousands of hours before you sit down in the flight deck of a large airplane, because you need to have the redundant flying skills built into your memory, your physical muscle memory. You have to know how to react. And in the most basic, dire emergency situation, you must be able to, you know, basically turn everything off, put your hand on the stick, so to speak, you know, the stick, the yoke, and fly the airplane. And it appears that these pilots either didn't have that skill or were distracted for some reason that we haven't found out about yet. So kind of a disturbing turn in the crash investigation. It'll be really, really interesting to see in the future where this investigation goes and what the ultimate recommendations from the NTSB are, and also the determination of the crash, whether it be pilot error or... maybe pilot error as well as mechanical irregularities or mechanical issues or you know, whatever. I also wanted to mention the FAA 1500-hour rule. This is something that came up as a result of the, ultimate result, along with a lot of pressure from a lot of different places. I believe even Captain Sully, Mr. Schellenberger, testified in front of Congress, gave testimony that ultimately led to the creation of the 1500-hour rule. But I digress. The thing that started this is the Colgan Airlines crash. They crashed a Q400, de Havilland Dash 8 Q400, which is a 70 or so seat turboprop. I think it was going into Buffalo, New York, in some inclement weather, icing conditions. The crew was long day, a little tired, it sounds. The captain had failed several proficiency standard checks at the airlines, and the first officer had been commuting all night on FedEx. She was up all night commuting into, I don't want to take a guess and get the information wrong, commuting to work to her domicile, and it just, the whole thing went from bad to worse. And I'm not, I don't want to talk about that crash, but the quote-unquote 1,500-hour rule. So the Congress basically came forward and said, I don't remember what the name of the bill is, but that pilots need to be trained better, and pilots need to have an airline transport certificate, or what you'll hear pilots call an ATP. They need to have this airline transport certificate before it's legal for them to fly in the right seat of an airliner. Now, all of this to the flying public sounds, you know, good, great, and dandy. The fact that pilots are now going to be more experienced, have more flying time behind the controls of an airplane, and therefore should be able to perform more adequately. What I want to talk about specifically, and this is kind of the purpose of my blog, what I wanted to share is my experience. So I started flying, I got hired at my airline with 200 and, I almost said 250 hours, with 890 or so hours. Later on, I want to talk a little bit about how I got started. But for right now, I flew charter for almost a year, 10 months before I got hired at my airline, my regional airline. So I came into my time breakdown, I guess. I came into the airlines with about 200 hours of flying at in college. That's doing commercial training for commercial and certified flight instructor and all that fun stuff. I had about 50 or so hours of multi-engine time. And then I had 45 or so hours of flying skydivers between my first and second semester. I only did a two-year program, so I didn't go to a four-year university. And then, so I got did charter. That was all twin, flying multi-engine airplanes. I flew my company, my charter company, which is now defunct, has been gone out of business, but had two Cessna 340s, Ram Series 340s. Pressurized piston engine airplanes, twins. Nice airplane. I enjoyed that a lot. We had a Navajo Chieftain, which was an awesome, awesome airplane. Really missed the Chieftain. We had a Piper 1040, PA-31T3T1040, which was, for your those airplane people out there, was a turbine-powered Chieftain or a unpressurized Cheyenne, however you want to look at it. It had 500 horse Pratt & Whitney PT6s, had a Navajo Chieftain fuselage, and then had a Cheyenne 2 wing and a little lower gross weight and fuel capacity. Piper actually built them. It was a production airplane, 70s and 80s, but they only built, I think, 24 of them. And every one of them's crashed except for, I think, four airplanes that survive. Two of which my company had, and we were tied for the largest operator in the world at two airplanes. flew charter, got my time flying charter, and then I came to the airlines at the age of 21. Yeah, I was 21 when I got hired. So the ATP rule, the 1,500-hour rule, was just a rumor at the time. It was still, they were working on it and arguing back and forth and so on and so forth. And I was building time and experience at the airlines, and then the ruling finally came out, and they said, I believe it was April, maybe. Oh, I shouldn't say. I'm not sure of the specifics, but they came out and said, spring of 2013, you have to have an airline transport certificate to fly at a regional airline. So I looked at that right away, and I kind of, you know, I went, yes, good. I turned 23 in March. So it was, you know, 35 days or whatever it was before this rule went into effect. So I immediately went to my logbook and made sure I had all the minimum time requirements. I had 2,000 or so hours at that point, a little bit more maybe. And so that was good. I was really happy that I met the requirements. Otherwise, I don't believe the FAA was planning to issue, to grandfather anybody into the new rule who currently did not meet the requirements. I think you you had to, I don't know, get your flying time somewhere else and get an ATP, or otherwise you couldn't continue to work as a first officer. So that was, I was really happy. But the testing process at the airline was really, I don't think, what the people who wrote the rule had expected. What I mean by that is the spirit of the law, the spirit of the rule, was to try and improve the quality of pilots who were flying, you know, who were flying at the airlines, at the Part 121 air carriers. But if you look at the standard that pilots are measured by, the practical test standards, or the PTS, it really is not very hard to get an ATP certificate if you've already been flying at the airlines. So the practical test standards don't have any guidance whatsoever on the flight director, which is a computer derived value, at least in my airplane. It's a computerized guidance system where if the pilot follows the cues from the flight director, he or she will have a high degree of accuracy, and it takes away about 75% of the mental flying skills required to actually fly an airplane. It really makes things easier on the pilot. But the practical test standards don't say anything about having to turn the flight director off. So when a pilot goes to take a check ride, goes to take get an ATP certificate, an upgrade from a commercial certificate, he or she is allowed to leave the flight director turned on, which alleviates 75% of his or her workload. So basically, we're allowed to cheat on the test. And all airliners, like in my particular case, I took my airline transport test, my check ride for my ATP certificate, in the simulator for the CRJ-200. So I was allowed to use my non-flying pilot, the captain, as a resource to help me configure the airplane and, you know, keep an eye out for traffic and make sure I didn't do anything illegal, or, you know, all available resources, what our manual says. I was allowed to use the captain and the flight director, and even in some cases, the autopilot. And it really was a letdown. You know, my whole career I had been heard, you know, oh, ATP, it's so hard. You got to fly to such exacting standards. And then I go to take the check ride, and it was a little bit like, oh, you know, yeah, another check ride. So what? You know, pretty standard. So it was a little disappointing. And, you know, and then it kind of got me thinking when I was reading a little bit more about this 1500-hour rule. And recently, I had a discussion with another pilot who was a trainee student of mine. We were talking about pilots and how the airline transport certificate in the modern day and age of automation and small airplanes really is not that outstanding of a measurement tool for pilot skill. It really doesn't do the job it was intended to do in the, you know, 60s and the 70s, when these regulations and these test standards started to come out and be developed by the FAA. They really don't apply to today's level of automation and the spirit in which the rule was intended. So I think it's a good idea all in all that the people who are flying, the airliners, and, you know, the students that I'm getting here at my airline, it's nice that they have a lot of time and experience doing, you know, flying. They have 1500 hours, but the ATP certificate specifically really allows, in the test standards, a lot of loopholes for pilots to get by using automation, which was what my second podcast and blog article was all about. Automation really can turn into a crutch for deteriorating pilot skill. So, you know, one step forward and two steps back. I don't know, two steps forwards and one step back. It really does help, though, having pilots, trainees come into my classroom who have a little bit of extra experience. I can say that having a 250-hour pilot try to learn the crew environment, the complex airplane, the systems, the limitations, the operational knowledge required of them, and then perform, it would be very difficult to try and teach or assist a pilot with that little skill set practical experience, because skill doesn't really, you know, pilots develop skill over time, but some pilots are more
naturally skilled at another. So I shouldn't say skill set. A pilot with such low time, they don't have a lot of experience to draw on, a lot of things to correlate what they're trying to learn in the jet to what they did in the 172. So a little bit about the $1,500 rule, my thoughts, my kind of view from the flight instructor's chair. Now I guess it's time to move on from those couple of news articles. I wanted to talk about how I got my start in aviation. I started young. I've progressed kind of quickly, and now I'm here at the airlines living my dream. So I wanted to try and share my secrets, I guess. No, not secrets. That's bad. I wanted to share my experience, tell you how I did it, and hopefully inspire, give advice to all of these listeners who are aspiring pilots. I got interested in aviation at a very young age, actually, at a sleepover. I was really young. I was 12 years old. I was at a sleepover hanging out with a friend of mine, up playing video games all night, you know, eating candy and just generally being mischievous, playing video games. And he, remember, he told me, he's like, oh, man, check it out. I got Flight Simulator 2002, which was brand new at the time. I was 12 in 2002. And, hey, man, check it out. Let's fly airplanes. We installed it on his computer. He had a little computer in his room, and then I think we'd like borrowed his mom's laptop. So we had both computers going, and we were flying around. I remember flying around a 747, and I just thought it was, you know, the coolest thing in the world. It was the cat's meow. And I think I stayed at his house for like 2 days straight, maybe, without going home. And finally, he, you know, he gets sick of me, and he says, you know, if you just want to play Flight Simulator, here, take it, push the game into my hand, and don't come back. So I ran home, kind of turned into a recluse, installed the airplane on my mom's laptop, and basically sat for 2 months and played nothing but Flight Simulator. At this point, it was just a hobby. It was just something I was interested in. I thought it was cool, you know, trains, planes, and automobiles. You know, when I was a little boy, I remember wanting to be a, you know, a train engineer, and I always thought cars and trains and trucks and transportation was neat and stuff like that. I can remember the moment, though, the exact moment, what I was doing, the approximate time of day. For some reason, it just sticks in my mind clearer than just about any other childhood memory. When I knew that I wanted to be a pilot, that I was born to be a pilot, I was flying on the game, of course, not in real life. On the game, I was playing. I was flying a Cessna Caravan, a 208 Bravo, into MIGS Airport. And I was flying from north to south, landing on the Chicago shoreline there. And of course, I had the airplane in the super realistic view, you know, the cockpit view where I could see all of the gauges and buttons and stuff. And I had read all of the informational material that Flight Simulator gives in its help or support or, you know, whatever that that portion of the program is. And I was flying this just god-awful, super high, unstabilized, you know, looking back on it. It was just, I mean, it's just a game, but I was flying this really, really bad approach. At, you know, at that point, I was just happy if I could get the airplane to actually touch down on the runway, let alone, you know, land without crashing. So I was flying it, and I remember thinking, you know, I was super young, but I just realized, holy cow, people get paid to do this for a living. That was a mind-blowing thought. It was a light bulb. It was a massive light bulb. It was a light bulb the size of the sun. You know, my father works a desk job, and that was really the only exposure I had ever had my entire life to work. I always thought work was, you know, you go to the office and you come home. But I realized that you could fly an airplane and get paid for it. And I thought it was just fun. So I was hooked. From that minute on, I was airplanes, airplanes, airplanes. I just want to fly airplanes. I was one of those people. So I basically spent the next 2 years, 2.5, almost 3 years pestering my parents. 3 years, I guess it was, about airplanes. I started asking for textbooks about airplanes for Christmas, birthdays. I wanted to take airplane rides. I took a EAA Young Eagles ride. right around this time frame with a local pilot who volunteered his time. That was very beneficiary. I got to see a 172 and take a loop around the pattern, hear the tower talk. It was really just fascinating. I really enjoyed it. And then when I was 15, it was the summer between my freshman and sophomore years in high school. I had been calling flight schools around the area, calling them and telling them to call back at 4 o'clock when my mom got home from work and talked to her. I even went so far as to invite a flight instructor to dinner without telling my mom. And she was, I don't think she was too happy about that, but she was nice. My parents were a little concerned about pulling the trigger on flight lessons because they thought it was maybe just a phase, you know, boys will be boys. And, you know, 1 minute it's airplanes and the next it's cars. And the next, you know, I want to be work on Wall Street and I'm off to college and didn't really want to be an airline pilot or a pilot after all. So that was not the case. I continued to kind of pester and ask and hint, wink, wink at every opportunity that I would like to take flying lessons. And eventually the opportunity came up through a Discovery Flight coupon, I think from learntofly.com. Not sure if that outfit is still out there, but learntofly.com. And I took my very first flight lesson with CFI, who actually, interestingly enough, now is employed at the airline that I work for, and she is a junior to me. So she taught me how to fly, and now she works at the same company I do, although she's 2 years my junior here at this company. Took my very first flying lesson, and I was hooked. I knew so much about the airplane from Flight Simulator. I had taken every lesson on the game. I had even started a small logbook and was doing flights and logging flights on Flight Simulator. Yes, I was a dork. I admit it. My hands are up in surrender. I was a dork, airplane dork. But I knew every question she was asking me, you know, I knew all the names of the instruments. I knew what they were used for. I knew how to control, you know, pitch and roll and power and all that stuff. So flight instructor was reasonably impressed with my, you know, computer learned flying skills. And I think my mom came along in the flight and actually got a little airsick in the back. But she held it together long enough for me to finish. And I was just, so close to a perfect greaser landing, but ended up plopping it on at just the last minute, which I guess all in all for, you know, a 15-year-old with no flight experience, I feel like I did okay. And from that minute on, I was hooked. My parents were sold. They saw how happy I was. So I started taking official flying lessons in the fall of 2005. I was, as most of you pilots out there know, you have to be 16 years old to solo. So that means to fly by yourself. So I was 15. We decided to take one lesson a month, one flying lesson a month. Because we were just kind of waiting out the time until I turned 16. I would not have been able to fly by myself. So we kind of spaced out that first 10 or 15 hours of flight training over about 10 or 11 months. And then as it got closer, the goal was to solo on my 16th birthday, which was the youngest possible day, the youngest possible age I could be, the soonest practical date. And as it got closer, we started to kind of watch the weather and think, you know, maybe this could work out, maybe not. And the day came of my 16th birthday, March 18th, I was born March 18th, 1990, but my birth date was, March 18th, and that was 2006. And the weather was windy, a little cloudy, and we went up and did some takeoffs and landings, and my instructor said, well, you know, we tried, but I don't think it's going to work out. And I was really, really disappointed. We came back to the airport, and there was actually a surprise party my parents threw in one of the hangars. So we had the surprise party, and lo and behold, about 6 o'clock at night, the wind had died down, the clouds had disappeared. It was a perfect fall evening. We went down to Oshkosh Airport, where EA Air Venture is, and I did 3 takeoffs and landings on runway 9. Runway 27, looking right there into the sunset. It was beautiful. And so I soloed right there on my 16th birthday, 2 days actually before I took my driver's test, which was kind of funny at the DMV. You guys better let me get my driver's license because I can fly an airplane by myself. So I continued the next year of flight training while I was in high school, while I was 16. I missed the 17th birthday. I wanted to do the check ride, the private pilot check ride on my 17th birthday, but just didn't quite work out that way. You know, life kind of gets involved. And, so I ended up getting my private pilot certificate when I was 17, during the age of 17, but not on my 17th birthday. It was a couple of months later in the middle of winter, when I actually took the check ride. So that was a pretty monumental, step right there, being a senior in high school and having a pilot certificate. So that was pretty exciting. During this time, junior, senior year of high school, 16, 17, I began to look at colleges. So my parents and I were all kind of wondering what type of school did I want to go to? Did I want to go to a big university or a small one? Did I even want to go to college at all? At the time, I was working on cars and trucks at a local auto repair shop, working as a mechanic. And I was thinking, well, maybe I could take a year off and, you know, just work and kind of, you know, do the, just, you know, take some time off. And decided that I was going to go to my local technical school, Fox Valley Technical College in Oshkosh, where they had a nice, tiny little aviation program. I think there was only 6 or 7 students. They had 4 airplanes. Four Cessna 172, 4 Skyhawks, nice Skyhawks, and a couple of older Duchesses, I think BE-76s, the Beechcraft Duchess, 4-seat, pretty standard twin engine trainer, just kind of like a Seminole, or equivalent, Aztec maybe. So I went down to Fox Valley Tech in the fall of 2008 after I graduated high school in 2008 in the spring. That fall, I went down to Fox Valley Tech in Oshkosh, about 30 minutes from my house. Really, really enjoyed that program. This is kind of where I wanted to give some advice. Now, I have a friend who did go to a large 4-year university. He went to University of North Dakota, actually 2 friends who are still in aviation, and I really would like to get their feedback. I might actually ask one of them to record a little bit and send me something. So maybe here in a couple of seconds, I'll be able to hit play and insert some of his feedback. But I really enjoyed my 2-year program, and I'll tell you why. It only cost me out of pocket about $40,000. Now, that $40,000 is a lot of money, but University of North Dakota, I think, is, you know, in the $100,000 range out of pocket, granted, without any scholarships or, you know, loans or, excuse me, without any scholarships or, you know, free money. The cost of the program is just astronomical, really, really, really high. They also, you know, have they go for 2 additional years, and they have a, you know, fairly well recognized 4-year degree, whereas I just have a 2-year associate's degree. And to be honest with you, I did not complete the entire program, and I currently do not have a college degree. Crazy, right? Not the best. I'm not saying that you should do what I have done, but I want everybody to know who's listening, who is thinking, well, I don't have the best grades in the world, or, you know, I really don't want to go to a large, prestigious 4-year university. It just doesn't fit, you know, in my personality, and so on and so forth. But you don't have to do that. There are alternatives which are most likely going to be cheaper for you out there. It doesn't necessarily require what you may think it requires. Getting to the flight deck of an airline, flying at a regional and eventually a major. So I went to Fox Valley Tech, did the 2-year degree, during which time I took only flight courses. I didn't take English class. I didn't take math class. I'm not, what you would call your typical student. I was pretty just focused on the flying portion of the training, and I received an excellent top-notch education. My class sizes were small. My instructors were personalized. They only had one or two students. So I had the same flight partner for 2 years straight, the same classes, the same five or six, you know, guys that I went to school with for 2 years. We only had two professors and I think three or four flight instructors total on staff. So it was a very personalized, very well organized, full of tons of resources, simulators that we could use around the clock, large library of technical, you know, aviation writing, as well as very skilled, talented instructors who were available to us 24 hours a day. Now, I'm not saying that instructors at large schools are not talented or available, but my school definitely, our instructors were not students who were still attending school. They were not, they had, you know, they didn't have 30 or 40 flight students. They were just specifically dealing with me. And that was really nice. I really liked that. It was a personalized touch that helped, I think, help me relax a little bit, get to know my flight instructor, be able to ask questions and really hone my skills. They did a great job during CFI training. The second year of the program was entirely CFI training, just going through and doing initial flight instructor, which turned out to be an MEI certificate, multi-engine instructor, getting an add-on rating for flight instructor and then instrument. So I have a CFI, an MEI-I or a CFI, CFI MEI with instrument rating or instrument rating tacked onto that, which I haven't used in years. But as an overview, I hear a lot of people ask, well, I'm thinking about going to you know, X, Y, and Z big fancy flight school for 4 years. And then do you think I should get a master's degree or would you recommend getting to the airline? My recommendation is find a school in your state, first of all, that will save you money on not having to pay out-of-state tuition. Find yourself a good school in-state and then decide, do you want a bachelor's degree or do you want an associate's degree or even a technical degree or no degree at all? Take a look at the culture at the school that you want to go to and the cost and, you know, your own personal situation and find something that suits your needs that's aviation related inside of your own state. I think the big flight schools have a tendency to try and sell you, you know, they're out to make money. They're not there to, you know, like a state funded institution. They're out there to try and, they're a business to make money off of you as a student, and they're going to use all of the advertising techniques that a business would use. They're going to try and attract you with big, fancy, flashy, colorful advertisements. They're going to hit you with how much technology they have. You know, Embry-Riddle's going to say, come and study with us. We have the most up-to-date, advanced technical GA aircraft, and we have the best simulators and the most instructors and blah, 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 blah. Now, I have flown with Embry-Riddle graduates. They are good pilots. They do a good job. This is not meant to be insulting to any Embry-Riddle pilots out there whatsoever, or North Dakota pilots, or any of you guys. I'm just sharing my point of view. So don't send your hate mail. So there a lot of these big pilot schools, they like to advertise their technology and their advanced automation in their aircraft and so on and so forth. But the pilot certificate that is given to a graduate of Embry-Riddle compared to the pilot certificate who is a graduate of Fox Valley Technical College are identical. And I think if you spend any time with commercial pilots, airline pilots, or charter pilots in the industry, there's a running joke that the certificates look exactly the same. One guy paid $140,000 at a big fancy four-year university, and the other guy paid $25,000 at Joe Schmo's flight school, and then went off and did an online degree while he was flying charter.
The drawback of that type of education system is that you don't have a reputable four-year degree from a flight school that has some weight with its name. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University is known around the world. So is University of North Dakota, the number one and number two flight school in the country, and quite honestly in the world. So that there's that aspect of it. I chose to do the latter. I chose to do the cheaper route. And now that I'm at the airline, I think I chose correctly for me, for my personal situation. I don't envy the guys who I work with, the other first officers who typically are a little bit older than I am. They're 25, 26 years old. They're making $30,000, $35,000 a year as first and second year first officers. First year first officer at a regional airline, you're going to make take home to the bank. You're going to make $24,000 to $27,000, $28,000. So that's not a lot of money to spend $140,000 on an education, and then first year at the job you want to do make $24,000 a year. That's, you know, like $1,600 a month. How you're paying $500 at least to your student loans, if not more, that really only leaves you with maybe $1,000 a month to live off of. And oh yeah, you got to live in New York unless you want to commute. It goes downhill pretty quick. So from the way the industry used to be, you could go to college and then you could learn how to fly and you could jump, you know, you could get hired at Delta. You didn't have to work at a regional. You could get hired at Delta or United or Northwest, and you could make $50,000 to $70,000, $80,000 a year as an airline pilot. They paid a lot better back then, and there was none of this low-cost regional express flying. So the income was a lot higher, and the cost of education and the cost of flight training, quite honestly, was cheaper in the 70s, 80s, and even in the 90s. Now, I digress a little bit from my original point, that being in my particular situation, my advice to somebody who is asking, do I go to a four-year university and then try to get hired at the airlines, or do I go to a flight school or maybe a technical college locally and then try to go to the airlines? My answer is to go to the local school. I think you'll spend less money and it'll get you to the job quicker. At the airlines, everything's based off of seniority. So date of hire, you get hired in, you know, 2014, you're going to be better off. You're going to get paid sooner, you're going to build seniority, and you're going to get to a major airline, which is the goal. Well, for most people, it's a goal. You're going to be able to move on sooner than the guy who gets hired in 2016 or 17 because he's off getting a four-year degree. Nowadays, the online degree is just as valuable as, you know, another degree from a big university. So, you know, there's kind of a joke. What's your degree in, Joe? It's underwater basket weaving. Okay, sounds good. You know, as long as you have a four-year degree, you have that piece of paper, it still lends the same amount of weight saying, you know, I have a four-year degree from Phoenix Online, or, you know, whatever, you know, blah, 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 flight school, or excuse me, university you want to choose for your online education. So that's my two cents worth. That's kind of how it worked out for me. Did the cheaper flight school route, got hired here at the airline after flying charter for a little while, and don't actually even have a college degree. I have plans to go to school, but I haven't yet. I'm just such a bad student. Not a bad student. I didn't enjoy school, and I don't look forward to going back. So something I really need to look into in the future. Maybe it's a possibility for me down the road, but right now, not enrolled in college, don't plan on it shortly. So
Now, I had some more topics here that I wanted to talk about: emergency procedures, fuel burn, a couple of funny stories I ran across, and then that was kind of the end of it here. I think I'm going to try and keep these original podcasts, the first couple here, down to about an hour, and it looks like I'm running at, there it ticked over to an hour right now as I'm looking at it. So maybe I'll leave you with a couple of funny stories, because I always like to talk about funny aviation stories. I don't think there's enough humor in aviation, so try to bring some humor into it, and we'll save these other two topics for another podcast, emergency procedures and fuel burn, related to the blog post I had. If you're interested in fuel burn, though, you can go to flapoperator.blogspot.com and look at my blog, short little article there about fuel burn, and get a sneak peek on what I'm probably going to talk about in the next episode. But some funny stories. Okay, so I had heard about this from another friend of mine, actually a captain I was flying with, who is a friend, I guess, a captain friend, a couple of months ago. Well, time flies. This was a year ago, at least, right after I had got hired at the airline. So two and a half years ago now. He had heard this story from somebody else. This is third person, and I decided a couple of months ago that I was going to try this out, and it was really with quite hilarious results. So the joke is, I jumped into the airplane, and the first officer always sits in the right seat of the airplane, and the captain always sits in the left seat of the airplane. That's pretty much the way it works at all air carriers. I don't know of anybody who does it differently, other than maybe the military. But in the civilian airlines, that's how it works. So I come running up front. I'm a young guy. Like I said, I'm 23, and I look young. I have kind of a baby face, I guess you could say. So most captains, when they first see me, they like to ask, how long have you been here? How many hours do you have? You know, they're worried I'm somebody's nephew and I got snuck into the business. So I kind of like to play on their suspicions a little bit. So I walk up front, and I look at the captain. I introduce myself. You know, good morning, sir. My name is Chris. I'll be your first officer today. And shotgun. He gives me a look like, oh no, who is this kid I have to fly with for 4 days? So I hit him with some hip hop gangster, talk. Yo, dog. Hey, man. How you doing? And he's over there on the left side of the airplane with his hands, just basically trying to ignore me at all possible costs. So I go outside and I do the walk around. I do the pre-flight inspection. Come back inside. I'm like, hey, man. You know, two engines, two wings, a tail. She's all good to go flying. Okay, thanks. Run the checklist. And we go to taxi out. And here's the joke. Here's what my friend told me to do. He said, while you're taxiing, put both hands on the controls. And I should back up. Airliners, most of them only have steer with a tiller on the ground. They steer with a little wheel, and only the captain has the tiller. So the captain always taxis. So as a first officer, my only duties are to keep my head up and make sure we're going the right direction and we're not going to run into anything. So my feet don't do anything. I don't taxi with my feet like you normally would. So my hands and feet are kind of free. So the joke is, while the captain's taxiing, you as the first officer put both your hands on the control wheel, the yoke, and stare very, very seriously out the front window of the airplane. Like you're concentrating really, really hard. This is funny because you don't have any duties whatsoever, really. So both hands on the wheel, concentrating really hard, looking out the front of the airplane. And when the airplane comes up to the first turn, and the captain moves the tiller, you gradually start moving the control wheel, the yoke, which is not connected to the wheels at all. It just deflects the flight controls on the wings so that we turn in the air. But on the ground, it doesn't do anything. And you stare very, very seriously. And the other guy, you know, the captain's over there kind of looking over at you like, what the heck is this guy doing? And every time he makes a movement with the tiller, you make a corresponding movement with the control yoke. And my personal record is about 7 minutes, but that's about the longest I've ever been doing this before the captain finally goes, man, what the heck are you doing? At which point I usually, burst out laughing and I go, I'm sorry, man. I'm just trying to break the ice. I'm just being funny, And then he laughs and goes, oh, thank goodness, because
I had no idea what you were doing. So my personal record is 7 minutes. I made it all the way from the gate, pushed back, taxied past, down the ramp, onto the taxiway, and we were turning onto the runway with me doing this very serious, you know, taxiing down on the control yoke. I haven't ever had anybody get mad at me, but it's a good icebreaker. I like to break the ice when I'm flying with somebody I've never flown with before by making some type of joke or using humor, usually at my own personal expense. So I think that's kind of funny. Another friend of mine, first officer who is observing me train this training period, he's learning to be an instructor as well. So I'm training him on how to become an instructor. He was up here in the hotel room last night. We were going over some things for today's flight lesson, and we got to telling funny stories. And I actually have a recording I thought I might put on here, and then I realized there was too many expletives used while we were joking around. So I'll give you the PG version. He tells a story that he was in the flight deck at cruise, up at cruise flight 30,000 feet or whatever it was, and the captain is kind of glancing up, and he keeps looking at the escape hatch up in the cockpit. We have an escape hatch in the ceiling, so if the cockpit door were ever to jam, we could go out the ceiling of the cockpit, and then there's a rope we could shimmy down to the ground. The captain kept looking at the escape hatch, and finally my friend looks over the captain, and he goes, what's wrong? What? And the guy goes, don't you hear that? And my friend, my first officer friend goes, no, I don't hear anything. And he goes, listen real carefully. My friend goes, I don't hear anything, man. He goes, take your headset off. Take it off. So he goes, okay. So he turns his speaker on for the radio and takes his headset off. And he's like, all right, you hear anything? And he goes, no. And he goes, well, why don't you stand up and put your ear next to the thing there? I think I hear something. So he stands up and he hears this psh, this air noise. And he goes, yeah, man, I hear something. And the guy's like, dang, I think I hear something too. He's like, try and get a little closer. So this whole time, my buddy's, you know, stretching his, you know, contorting his body and all these goofy, you know, like raises his seat all the way up, and he's stretching his seatbelt to the limit. He's really trying to, you know, cranks his head sideways to put his ear up there. And every couple of seconds, he hears this noise, this psh, oxygen whistling or air pressure whistling kind of noise. And he goes, oh, man, he's like, is the hatch going to, you know, are we leaking? Like, are we going to be in trouble? Is there going to be a deep pressure, you know? And my buddy's starting to get a little worried. And the captain, after about, you know, 5 or 6 minutes of this, he goes, no, man, I'm just messing with you. He was doing the test on the oxygen mask the whole time. Every time he would test the flow of the oxygen, and it would sound like the overhead hatch was leaking. So my buddy's up there trying to go ahead, get a little bit closer, Oh yeah, take your headset off. And the captain's over there just messing with him, playing with his oxygen mask the whole time. Oh, so we had a good chuckle about that last night. I thought that was pretty funny. So, how are we doing for time here? Minute and an hour and 8 minutes. So I guess I'll stop there. I've got a couple more, but we'll save those for next time. So want to thank everybody, I guess, for joining us here, the Flap Operator. Don't forget to check out flapoperator.blogspot.com. And also look in the near future. I'm going to transition all of my podcasts over to a new hosting site, and then kind of go a little bit more of the professional route here, get off of Podomatic, where everything's being hosted right now. So I think the next episode, or maybe the episode beyond that, episode 4 or 5, we may begin a new hosting service. So keep an eye out for that. Definitely go ahead and visit flapoperator.blogspot.com. Check out some of the articles I've got on there and future posts. Keep an eye out for new episodes. Drop me some feedback. Let me know what you thought about the current episode, and if there's anything specifically you want to hear me talk about, if you want to hear about more maybe about the autopilot system itself, or, you know, how the fuel system works, or, you know, airlines in general, anything. I just really enjoy talking about airplanes.
I like talking about explaining some of the more technical aspects that the long-winded answers, so to speak, that I can't quite give at dinner parties. So I'm going to try, I think, to pick a system at each week and talk about the different systems moving forward. I appreciate everybody joining me here on the Flap Operator Podcast. This is Pilot Chris signing off. Blue skies and landings as soft as a butterfly with sore feet. Goodbye.